this is Mitchell Levy from Happy About, and thanks for joining us for another great hour with one of our very successful and what will prove to be a very thought-provocative author, Tim Toster. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Well, a pleasure.
So what's really fun about this book series that we're talking about, in this specific book, this is the Think Aha series. The Think Aha series is comprised of books which are 140 tweets. So your ability to consume them takes about 20 minutes. But what I'd like to propose is that these are not really books. Although, you know, if you buy the physical book, they look and feel like a physical book. We have an ebook format. We have an iPhone app. There are a number of different ways for you to consume these books. But what I will call them is contextual learning experiences. Because if you are reading this book and you're plowing through it, the context in which you read it changes depending on, you know, where you are at a particular point in time. I'm personally, every month at the beginning of the month, I'm reading a book called Leadership Tweet. And myself as a leader keeps changing. My employees keep changing. And so the view of the world, the context in which I'm reading the book continues to change. Nothing is more so than the book by Tim Toster, Death Tweet, because as life goes on, we eventually reach the point where our friends, our family, ourselves will die. And having ability to face it head on and view it is something that Tim has tackled. And so, Tim, why don't you first talk just a little bit about yourself and who you are, and then we'll talk about your book.
Well, I'm kind of a peculiar author in this subject matter. I came to the subject through actually a relatively long path. When I'm actually a land use and environmental lawyer. I'm engaged in getting permits for large-scale projects all over California. And I've been doing that for 36 years. When I was about 41, I had an experience where I'd had a mole taken off my back, and I was told there was no risk of cancer with that. And I went back about 3 years later and asked to the doctor to re-excise it because I could feel something in my back, and they told me on the second effort that it was still clear. And 3 years later, I could feel a lump. My back was itching. I went into the original doc, and I said, would you please give me my slides from the last two biopsies, which they did. And I took it up to the UC Melanoma Center, where the pathologist declared that actually it had been a melanoma for 6 years.
Wow.
At that point, it's kind of not good news. I don't know what the state of the art is currently, but at that point, which was 19 years ago, if a melanoma becomes metastatic, it's not a pretty picture. Chemotherapy doesn't work. X-rays don't work because melanomas tend to go off like grenades and they just go all over your body. So it's kind of a search and destroy mission. So I learned from the original physician that he thought that it was very deep, likely metastatic, and I might have 2 years to live. At that point, I had 3 kids under 9. I was a complete hot dog, kind of a male taking over the earth, you know, trying to be a rich, famous, powerful lawyer. And I'd really not paid a whole lot of attention to the world around me in the quest for my career. And that really kind of set me back. It's an amazing thing to have your life redefined by a disease. So I spent about 6 weeks between that original prognosis and lining up a surgeon, and the tumor was excised, and it was very close to the bloodstream, which was the major concern because it tends to break up and get carried around your body by the bloodstream and attaches to various organs. But it didn't look like that had happened. So I moved from a 2-year horizon to a 7-year horizon, and it was thought that if I didn't have a metastatic melanoma after 7 years, it was probably clear. So I had moved from the 2-year life framework to the 7-year life framework, and I realized that I really didn't know how I was looking at life, and that kind of set me off on a search for how to live a life where I'm really engaged with my family, my kids, where I'm actively living life. And, you know, 20 years ago, there wasn't really a path. At the Melanoma Center, they hand you a card of a psychologist and say, go talk to him. And then they ask you about your past, and that's really not a very useful engagement. So I began studying philosophy and religion and psychology, and really dedicated a large part of my spare time to just trying to find a reason to or a basis of belief that would help me support a life that was a better life, a more engaged life, a more fulfilling life. And I began to practice yoga, which helped slow me down. I started to meditate, which also opened up doorways to new ways of seeing life. And about 6 years ago, I was introduced by a friend to the Zen Hospice Project, which is a volunteer service for folks who want to sit at the bedside of the dying at Laguna Honda Hospital, which is San Francisco's big public hospital. And as soon as my friend mentioned that, I knew that that was something that I couldn't say no to. I went into the initial interview, and when I was asked by the guy that screened us, you know, what did I think was behind that, I had all kinds of noble thoughts. And he said that, you know, and they didn't have to do with the cancer. And then he looked at me and said, well, I think this has more to do with your cancer than anything else. And it was like so obvious, but I didn't see it. So I went into the training, and I've been sitting at the bedside of the dying in San Francisco for 6 years. At Laguna Honda, we're dealing with homeless people, we're dealing people with AIDS, we're dealing with people who have frankly outlived everyone in their lives. They're in their late 90s, early hundreds, their children are dead. It's really an enormously diverse population, but it's also a population that is not what I'm accustomed to seeing as a lawyer. So it became a really heart-opening experience for me. And out of observing, we have a 26-bed ward. It's an open ward, meaning that the people aren't in rooms. They're in these large facilities, which the federal government has been closing down, saying they are not sufficient to meet legal standards for care. So we'll be moving into a new hospital. But you know, one of the things that happens is when you have 26 people and it's half men and half women, a community starts to grow out of that. So I was in a community where everyone knew that their lifeline was relatively short. And I began to see things happen again and again that were great teachers for me. And I used to learn these lessons and bring them back into my law career and say, okay, I feel so different based on what sitting with someone who just died, how can I hold on to that value? How can I engage this life in my law career, my family, and hold on to that incredible space that was created by sitting with someone dying? So Death Tweet really, well, as you remember, I came to write a different book, and I had sent you my hospice stories. I started writing stories about the various people I cared for about 2007, I think. And I gave you a batch of my stories to prove that I could write. And you sat down with me, and I had a book proposal for a business kind of book. And you handed me a copy of your AHA book series and said, no, this is what you should write.
So when you actually do present a book proposal to a publisher, if you are sending samples of your writing material, be cautious.
Yeah, you may get something back. And it was really amazing because here's this book, you know, I wanted to write narrative, and you come back with, I want you to write 140 tweets and we'll talk about death. And I thought, wow, that's about it. I can't imagine anything less sexy, because death is the proverbial elephant in the room. We put people in hospitals. We put people in elder care facilities. We put people away from us as they die. But they're also some of the strongest relationships we have in life. And we're so afraid of confronting death that we distance ourselves from it. And it's an extraordinarily intimate time. And it's an extraordinarily caring time. And I don't think you can be a better human being at any time in your life than to be with someone as they die. because there's nothing more that a dying person needs than you to be there while they die. This is just—it's just so overwhelmingly clear as you sit with folks.
Well, it reminds me, Tim, I think it was the first story, your first hospice scenario. By the way, for those, we'll open the lines in about 20 minutes for those have questions. And if you want to send a question over email, send a question to info@happyabout.info, and I'll repeat those. But Tim, you know, I remember the first story, the first hospice story you read me, and I was just so touched by that one. And maybe you could just, you know, spend a couple minutes talking about that one.
Well, it was an incredible story because what happens at hospice, you train for the passing of people, and you know that at some point that actually might happen. But my first death that I witnessed sitting at a bedside was like my second week of being in the program. And the gentleman was really quite sick. He was in what we call active dying. Active dying is a point in time when basically the resident goes inside. I mean, people use their energy to keep alive, and as they get very near the end of death, their eyes will close. They will go into a state where all of the energy is basically devoted to keeping the heart pumping and the brain supplied with blood and the lungs filled with air. And I'm sitting with this. I go into the room, and he's surrounded by his brother and his wife and their son who had Down syndrome, and the kid was about 18. And I said, "Is there anything I can do to help?" And they said, "We'd really like to go out to dinner, get some food. We just flew in. I wanted to see my brother, but we'll be back very shortly." And they left. And they asked me to stay with him, and I sat there, and I just kind of tried to match his breathing and see if I could. This is just going to sound very weird, but what happens is, as you hear someone struggling with breath, I meditate to see if I can pull them into my breathing pattern from theirs. It may seem very strange, but when people go inside, they're still kind of conscious of the outside world. So what happened is I was trying to see if I could get his breathing more regular, which doesn't really happen at the very, very end of life. And I kept breathing, and suddenly I thought, he's doing it. We're really in sync. I don't hear anything. And so I just sat in meditation for a while, and then I opened my eyes, and I looked at the bed, and I said, wow, I don't know if he's breathing at all. And his torso was against a darker wall, so I waited to see his chest or diaphragm move up and down, and it wasn't moving. And I put my hand on his hand, and it was cold. And he had passed while I was meditating. His brother and sister-in-law came back with the son, and as I was just sitting with the body and had it confirmed with the doctor that he indeed had passed. And I took on this incredible role relative to the brother and his family, which was I became the conduit. I had been the witness to the passing. And we're dealing with a man that I think was probably a blue-collar worker from a world that didn't touch. And the first thing he did is he just put me into this incredible bear hug and just said, thank you for being with him. And the wife came around the other side and the son, and they were all in this huge embrace for the fact that what I had done is sat with him as he died. And that was the first death I had ever witnessed. And it really spoke to me in a way that said, this is extraordinary what I'm being allowed to do.
Tim, it brought tears in my eyes the first time I read it. Caused me to want to have you do a book in this, and still brings tears from my eyes listening to it now.
Go ahead.
I wanted to, this is the type of strong emotion that can come out of death. But I wanted to talk about your book being not really about death, but it's really about living life. And it, you know, I'm thinking about tweets.
That's hard
you know,
to tell from the first
here.
20 minutes we just went
no,
through.
No,
in fact, you're right. You're
but
right.
I'm looking at tweet number 111. Approach every human interaction with empathy and generosity. And you obviously did it there, but why don't you talk a little bit about that and a couple other tweets in the book.
Okay, so what happened is I realized this was really powerful stuff. Can I take this back to my law practice? Can I take this feeling? What is it I am feeling? What is it that I'm learning from this? And can I take it back into my law practice or my interactions with my family and be a better person for the fact that I've been through this experience? And I identified, I like to publicly speak. I'm in my profession, I speak all over the country to major organizations on issues related to what I do for a living, the law and land use and the environment. I decided I wanted to put a talk together on the lessons. I called it Lessons for the Living. And I identified five things that I watch dying people go through. Now, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is really the genius that started really making a medical discipline of working with the dying, has a five stages that she talks about. Mine are different. What I started to see is that everyone goes through the same kinds of things that have incredible direct application to your life. That is, you don't have to wait to die to discover these things. And if you find a way to cope with them, deal with them, embrace them now, your life just gets better. And everyone that struggles with them at the end of life learns the same thing. But if you can, you know, if you get a 30-year jump on it, everything gets a lot easier. Those things are change, control, perception, discovery, and relationship. And I'll go through those kind of quickly. One of the things that happens when people are dying is their life starts to change radically. Their body no longer works. They can't drive. They may not be able to go to the bathroom. They may not be able to feed themselves. So they're dealing with this highly tumultuous world in which change is happening really fast. And I noticed in going back to the world of the not imminently dying that we're out here having a great deal of difficulty with change as well. So what I learned was that we have to be ready for change. Change is happening all the time. And if we can't really embrace the fact that our world is very dynamic, we make ourselves, frankly, miserable. And can we find a way to kind of go with the change as opposed to resisting it? Because resisting it's kind of a fool's errand. Control is a very similar circumstance where, you know, most of us first see it when we ask our parents to give up their car keys because they're no longer really able to safely be on the road. But control really accelerates toward the end of life, and you just have to have things that you give up. So the question is, can you release yourself from having to control everything? And we are thoroughly habituated to trying to control things. And the funny thing is we make ourselves absolutely miserable by trying to control things that we couldn't have controlled in the first instance, but we get ourselves into the illusion that we're having some impact on the world. So it's the second thing is to reframe how we think about controlling things and to be exceptionally wise about what we can't control so we don't spend a lot of energy dealing with it. And rather, it becomes like an artful judo or aikido move where we know that the control is not ours to have, but how do we move in relationship to something we can't control so we don't use energy but we get an effective outcome? The third thing is perception, where once you become, you know, captive to your bed or captive to a ward or captive to a bedroom in your house, if you think of the world as you used to think of it, you're just going to suffer. Whereas what I watch with dying people is a visit by a dog or a potted plant or an art book or having poetry read to you or having a massage given to you become acts of extraordinary giving and extraordinary receiving, because the framework of how you have seen the world or you used to see the world is losing its relevance, and there's this whole new world opening up to you. But that takes a certain awareness that the world is shifting and that there's richness in what's left, even if the things you used to do are no longer available. So perception is another major, major ingredient toward the end of life. Discovery is similar. It's related to perception because
So please continue a moment, but I wanted to point out that each one of these sections or each one of these areas that Tim's talking about, he puts a number of tweets or aha moments in the book, and I'm flipping through here and looking at these things and trying to, you know, figure out which ones are really move me. But, you know, one is, you know, tweet number 78, which dying presents an extraordinary opportunity to shift perspectives. And I think as we've heard you talk, you absolutely have an opportunity to change who you are and what you think. And I think if you're smart enough and you're listening to this call and you're reading your book, if you could change your perspective even before you get to the point where you absolutely know you're dying in a short period of time, I think that's kind of what you're encouraging people to do.
The point is, why wait until the end of your life to discover this? There's nothing that says this is late in life discovery. It could be yours right now. I just had this thing happen. I'm going to protect the person that sent it to me. But I got an email Sunday morning. You know, most of us that do these books don't do them to make money. I'm a lawyer. I want to see Mitch do well. I want to have people get these messages. I don't think we have to suffer as much as we do. And the point of this book is to maybe provide a little relief. But I got an email from a man who said, I'm a 60-year-old man living in Virginia. And just this past January, I was diagnosed with stage 4 form of brain cancer. To say I was moved and motivated by your book is an understatement. I have been spending a considerable amount of time since my diagnosis thinking about the many issues you've described in your book and take immense comfort in your thoughts and commentary. Using your words to describe where I am on my journey, I'm now at 45, and then he quotes it, remember that your survival is not about living forever. It's about living consciously, meaningfully, and lovingly. And number 81, have faith in your ability to perceive life anew in its fullest dimensions, with a goal of reaching number 13. As you explore life's meaning, an amazing thing happens. Your life comes into balance. I very much look forward to reading your next book. Thank you for your insight, thoughts, and assistance in helping me better understand the issues that lay before me. You know, I didn't ever see a reader like this wonderful guy. I mean, I didn't see that coming. What I was thinking is I was writing for a secular business audience. I was thinking I was writing this book for lawyers whose hearts have really become too hardened, for bankers, for real estate executives. I had no clue that this book would find its way into the hands of dying people and that their response to it, you know, would be what I just read. But that started to happen to me before when I wrote the hospice story. So, you know, I guess what I'm seeing is that and I firmly believe this, we want to be more connected. We want to understand these issues, but we got to get over this initial hurdle of actually saying that, you know, that we can talk about death or it's acceptable to use these lessons to bring into our lives. And if the only way you can learn the lessons is to confront the demon death, then let's do it and make our lives better.
Amazing. So I cut you off before you had a couple other points. You were three of five into your.
Yeah. Point. Okay. So I was talking. The next one is discovery. As your perception shift, you get to discover a whole new world that has been recontoured by the fact that your life is different now. So that fascination with the coarse hair on a golden retriever that's come in to visit you becomes a world in itself. You know, you look into the dog's eyes, you rub its muzzle, you feel the warmth of its body. That becomes the world for you at that moment. And the thing that so many of us have forgotten to do is to pay attention to that level of detail in our daily life. And so I have a dying person teaching me, how can you ignore this plant, this beautiful plant? We'll sit there and we'll talk about a plant or an animal, or we'll read a poem and they'll just be, you know, wash in it. I have a habit of taking a ukulele and playing songs to folks, and, you know, it's really a testament to their fortitude to listen to me sing and play. But there's also this bond that occurs, and we talk about the song. Or I'll be playing to like a 95-year-old woman, and she'll tell me how she and her husband used to dance to that. Or I'll be sitting with someone who is said to be cognitively impaired and doesn't speak, but when I play a song from the 20s, they'll sing in perfect, you know, intonation. And then when the song's over, they won't say another word. So there is this discovery that is something that we've gotten too busy, too important, too preoccupied to pay attention to.
Hey, do you want to retweet either 97 or 98? Or do you want me to do that for you?
No, I happen to have the book here.
They're both really.
97 says, "Can you make your life at this time so rich that you don't need to be rescued?" And 98 is it possible for you to find opportunity in adversity, to discover that setbacks are just a reset button to replay the game? You know, this was really, the book format was really a considerable challenge. When you told me I had to write 140 tweets, I thought, piece of cake. And I went off to Colorado for a vacation. I wrote like 200 and came back. And I didn't realize how the format really made you write a haiku or a poem. Because you can say 140 things at the drop of a hat, but moving someone from the first tweet to the 140th tweet in a way that doesn't scare them off, because we have this audacious title, Death Tweet, and open your heart so that people can feel you in what you're saying, was an extraordinary challenge. But I was telling a friend today at lunch that it was one of the most remarkable things I ever did for myself, because I could feel what I was writing. I moved out of my head, and I moved into a place in my heart where when I wrote these things, I could actually feel the connection. So I've had people tell me when they read the book, they'll start the book like, can we skim through this, as you said, in 20 minutes? And they've said, you know, each one of these stops me. So I have to stop and breathe in between. So this is not a 20-minute book. In fact, it's a book that I've read like 4 or 8 times. One of my friends on Easter went to her family gets together and they read poetry to each other. And I somehow made the cut because they were reading tweets out of Death Tweet interspersed with the poetry. I mean, I didn't design it for that, nor do I think it's, you know, we're not talking about great literature. I think what we're talking about is people that are very hungry to connect at a different level, because we've culturally deprived ourselves of our connectedness to one another. I'm so glad that's on tape, so I stuttered twice. relationship is the last one, which is, you know, which is so perfect for for what I just said. One of the things that dying teaches you is nothing's more important than your relationship to other people. I mean, there's no power, there's no wealth, there's no, you know, a claim to fame that is going to be worth a damn as you're entering into that phase of the end of your life. And when you watch people teach you that again and again and again at the end of life, we have, as I said, we have 26-bed ward. On average, 13 people die every month. So I have relationships with people that have gone on for a couple of years because they didn't die, and I've had relationships with a person for like one evening. And I've written about a relationship with a person for one evening that was one of the most moving ones I've ever had in hospice. But you can have an intimate relationship that is extraordinarily powerful in a course of hours, so why wouldn't you? And that I take back into life. I take that into life because it makes life so rich. You know, and I'm an advocate. I'm a paid advocate. And I'm supposed to, you know, take my clients' expectations and deliver on them. But it's very interesting because I've reframed that to find a way to have a greater success by soft, by not selling. It's by linking up the humanity of the sides so that all of the ego stuff starts to melt away a little bit and they come to a greater, more meaningful, more long-lasting understanding because they didn't put all the cultural stuff that we've acquired in the last, you know, 50 or so years in the way. They've made their way to the relationship with my help. And working from a relationship is so much better than working through a lawyer. It really is. I mean, it's not in my best financial interest, but I don't think I wasn't going to continue to be a lawyer if that's how I had to continue to act. So the relationship piece is so extraordinary. Now, going all the way back to the first story you asked me to talk about, I don't think anyone should have to die alone, but some people want to. So when the brother came in to see, when the brothers came together, even though one was in active dying, there was a need to have that event happen. And having the one brother go out to dinner so the other could die is very typical.
Interesting.
And so the point isn't that you're there at the bedside at the moment of death. The point is that there is this relationship that is secured so that someone can transform, so that they can pass. I mean, at the end of life, what you get to feel like is that there's this spirit or soul or whatever that wants to detach itself from the body, and you can actually, as you watch this again and again, you begin to see how that detachment occurs. And the point of it is that in life, you know, we are detached. We are so detached from one another that you want to make sure you're engaged before you detach. And that's what I watch in kind of in these moments with people who, I had one woman who was schizophrenic. And at the end of her life, we were talking about the fact that she had two adult sons. And she was talking to me about, she was just completely lamenting the fact that she had no idea where they were. They had no idea where she was, and she was about to die. And she had given them up and lived on the streets for like 30 years. And she actually, you know, her disease, her mental state was a problem, but as she died, as she got toward the end of her life, she got really peaceful, and she did not appear to be a schizophrenic. And so we had this conversation in which we talked about, really, wasn't it better that she didn't leave on her sons the track marks of her schizophrenia? Wasn't it better that maybe the best thing she could be as a mother was to be away? That gave them the greatest opportunity to make their lives whole. And she died peacefully because she found a way that the particular way she did her mothering was, given her mental competency, was the best she could do as a mother.
Amazing. What a wonderful story. Hey, if people want to ask questions, you could either send email to info@happyabout.info or hit the *6 to unmute yourself and ask a question. We had a couple that came in, but if anyone wants to Come On, Please Do. Why don't you do it in a minute or two? Tim, why don't you, what have we not talked about so far that you want to share?
So when you get through all those lessons, you'll find there are these things that are kind of common to all of them. And one of them is that you have to slow down enough. When you're talking about paying attention to change or control or perception or discovery or relationship, it actually assumes that someone's in there. And so one of the things that came out of our Zen hospice tradition, because it's a Zen tradition on how to sit with the dying, is that we use meditation as a way of getting back in connection with ourselves, back in touch with our bodies, slowing our mind down so that we have the time to be in the present moment, to create a sense of spaciousness from which we can be aware of these issues of control and change and the like. So one of the things I've learned is to become aware in life. Like before this interview, I'm not particularly shy or have difficulty speaking, but I sat for 15 minutes in meditation before getting on the phone for this call, because I wanted to make sure that none of the things that had happened in the course of my day today, which was pretty challenging, interfered with my ability to connect with you guys. And I know that I can be distracted and distractible, and I wanted you to hear me from the most incredible deep heart place that I could achieve at the end of a long business day, because my purpose in having this conversation is to kind of interest you in looking at your life differently so you can live your life better. So one of the things to become aware of is, can you ever create the space from which awareness grows so that you can be aware of how change is ruling you or control is ruling you or your perceptions are too narrow? So one of the things that is an important underlying element to all the teachings is you have to have the ability to be quiet enough to learn. And I found that once you're quiet enough to learn, then there's this interesting thing that happens, and it was really what happened to me out of the cancer experience. I didn't really have the right words for it for a number of years, but what I was really looking for is, what is my life's purpose? And life's purpose isn't really, it's not like you go, got it, and then you're there. The quest for a life's purpose is kind of a trek. And as long as you're thinking, what am I doing on this planet? And you get up every day and you kind of keep that in mind, you start to zero in on a path. And what happens is, Mitch talked about it earlier. He said he reads the Leadership Tweet book, and every day the book's the same, but the context is different. You didn't exactly say it that way, but that's what I heard.
That sounds great.
So every time the context changes, the same information takes on a new way of being. And so when I'm doing this work of finding my life's purpose, every day offers me another way of seeing my purpose. But one of the incredible things about trying to align yourself with your purpose is that your goals get a lot clearer, because you want to do stuff to get to your purpose. So then you know what your intentions are, and then you set your priorities. So if you have your purpose, your goals, your intentions, priorities, suddenly you start doing what's important, and you stop doing what's not important. And it's amazing what you thin out of your life because you had thought it was important, because you hadn't really thought about, you know, what's important and what's not, or you didn't know how to put that into a context. So when you quiet down, this issue of purpose comes up. And in the issue of purpose, you can start unloading things that are kind of culturally imposed. Like maybe it's the right thing to be at every kid's soccer game. But if you're at every kid's soccer game and you have four kids and you don't breathe on weekends, your parenting's going to get impaired.
Mm.
You know, so what I found is that if you move to the awareness – pursue the purpose, your life comes into balance, and voila, you get happy. What an amazing thing that is. You get happy because you were outside your purpose. I had a coaching client that we do an intake interview. It's like a two-hour interview before you take someone on to see if you're the right mix and try and see if you can find the right entry to that person, the right way of approaching their issues so that you can open a door for them. And so I asked this woman who was describing this extraordinarily compressed and hectic schedule, well, have you ever thought about your purpose in life? And she just started to cry. And she looked at me and she said, I've never thought about that issue.
Okay.
And that coaching began at that moment, you know, because, you know, it's just, I don't know if you feel it. I've actually made, you know, some people depressed by asking them the question, but the answer is don't get depressed. Just kind of relax. It's not a search. You don't go to the encyclopedia for it. You know, it's kind of a relaxing into what are the things that have always been what made you feel real and alive and caring and compassionate. Where are those places? And what is it that is similar about those that might send you on a path to find that purpose? And the more time you spend in those spaces that are rich and generous and comfortable, you know, the more your life's going to be like that. And then what happens out of that, and my wife, who may be on this call but will probably remain anonymous, is that when you get into that space, you actually become someone much more lovable. My wife has described to me the change in me just from these years of caring for the dying, because I've kind of just gotten softer in a nice way. I'm still kind of pig-headed in some aspects, but
as your publisher, I can say that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I have some views of what will really, like Death Tweet. Why did I leave Death Tweet as a name? Everybody told me to give up on the name Death Tweet. And I left it at Death Tweet because I wanted it to be a little bit in your face. If I can't get you beyond the title, I mean, if I called it Life Tweet and then started talking about death, you'd feel like I snookered you. So I put Death Tweet right out there because I wanted to, like, there is an elephant in the room. Let's say that the elephant's in the room. But then let's say what a wonderful elephant it is and what a great teacher it can be, and turn that whole concept on a dime into something that's rich and engaging and useful.
Well, I think, sir, you answered, we got a couple questions over email, but I think you just answered one of them in your discussions.
Why'd I name it Death Tweet?
Yeah, we got that one too. But it's more of the what was a few of the teachings you have learned from people you have cared for?
Oh, you know, one of them for me, I want to mention this one because this is a really incredible thing. I always thought that love, I kind of had this view of love is that you have the family love, you know, and that's kind of like that's almost like the consequence of being human, and you have your immediate family and you love them no matter what. And I had a kind of Ozzie and Harriet upbringing, so I didn't realize that families could be so dysfunctional that love inside the family, as I assumed it, was not possible. And then there was this, you know, love that comes about from the fact that I'm man, you're woman, you know, you're going to have this one great love. And so love kind of constituted these two parts, the part that was automatic because it was family and the part that it was like this deep romantic thing. And working with the dying taught me that I could fall in love and become intimate in the sense of bearing who I am as they bared who they were in minutes. In minutes, you can be such a loving person to someone. And I began to realize that the way I had boxed love was denying it to me because I treated it so narrowly and so specialized and so inaccurately that I realized that love is just here. And you got to be careful in the business world that you don't, you know, and I, you know, and if, it's really funny to say this, but, you know, probably most of my clients would like to nod their heads and say, yeah, I get that, but they wouldn't let it show in a cultural setting. I'm in this totally male, macho world of real estate. But the fact of it is that I think most of us do way too much to get somebody to say that you're alive. I see you. Like, you know, a woman friend was telling me about her son cooking eggs, and he says to his mother, "See me, mommy, see me, mommy." And I think in our adult lives, that's what we want to do, is we want people to see us. But the way you really see people is to care about them, to validate them. And that's what love is, and that is so much more available than we get. I mean, the way we've been trained, we don't know. It's just sitting out there. It's a big, powerful thing. And when I have people do an exercise on their life's purpose, when I'm doing group coaching, I create dyads where there'll be just two people sitting with each other, and one asks the other time and again for about 5 minutes, "What's your life's purpose?" And it's the only question they ask them, and the other person responds. You thank them, and then you ask them the question over and over and over again. And what happens is as you go through that for 5 minutes, is the person, "What's your life's purpose?" You might hear, "Well, to be a great lawyer or be a great father." And you ask it again, and it drops down a little bit deeper. And after 5 minutes, they're in a zone that is a really different zone from the first time the question was asked. Because they can both hear what they're saying and feel in their body how it feels, and they know it's not quite true enough. And when you go deeper and deeper and deeper, almost everyone gets to the point of saying that they want a caring relationship with others, or they want to be in a relationship to help others. At the end of all of those tests that I've run on it, it ultimately comes down to the fact that we want to be connected, we want to be seen, we want to be validated, and we want to offer that up to other people. And that's what I do at hospice. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book, so that we can all see one another, so we can all regard one another in a richer way. Because so much of what's wrong with the world is we don't do that.
I am in agreement. Wow, this is very moving, Tim. Thank you. If anyone has questions, send an email to info@happyabout.info. We got another one that came in. Or you could *6 to unmute yourself. I think we have time for a couple more questions. I think we have 5 or 10 minutes left. We had one come in, Tim, that brings us back a little bit. It has to do with control.
Mm.
And it's, how do you deal with the subject of control for yourself? And then, while you're at it, how do you help others deal with it?
Well, there's, you know, when you're engaged, you're kind of there's a certain ambivalence. Like for me to engage with someone at the deathbed, I always take a little bit of time to quiet myself down, so that when I sit down with them, they are not just getting my reactions. I don't bring a lot of belief or judgment to the bedside, because I really want to see where the person is at, in their struggle or in their process at that moment. And if I have my own expectations of where they're going to be, I could operate really poorly by not seeing where they actually are, but operating off my expectations. Well, you know, that's a precious thing to do when you're sitting with a dying person, but when you think about it in your life, you know, you're sitting there with your spouse or your children with these highly habituated beliefs and judgments about them because you've been with them so long. And is there a chance you could quiet down enough to look at your lovely wife and say, to yourself, where is she now? And approach it without so much desire to have an outcome, but more with a desire to let something new come out of this exchange. Now, Nancy, you know, would, my wife Nancy would say, maybe I hit that like 1 out of 10 times. but I hit it 1 out of 10 times, you know, because that's better than I used to do. But I at least know that, that if I can let go of my own desire for an outcome, I have a greater chance of seeing her where she is. And where they are is really changed by the way you are approaching it. So this kind of habitual behavior, the dance that you do with another that you know really well, starts to shift the very moment you stop being like you used to be. Because they perceive a space. Maybe they don't have to react quite the way they're used to reacting because they're not getting that feedback they're used to getting from you. And so it's not like an overnight thing, but if you get the taste of it, there's this sweet taste that comes from just recognizing that the way you've been acting with someone is got a little more room than you thought. And then you really have to, you have to treat it really respectfully because you've just started to create something new. So don't feel the need to go back to where you were. Just kind of, this is that discovery piece. This is that shifting perception piece.
Got it. Makes a whole lot of sense. Do we have anyone with questions out there? Somebody want to bring something up specifically for Tim?
I thought I heard someone go unmuted.
I went unmuted. Mitchell?
Yes.
Oh, I sent you an email, but I don't know if it went through. I just wanted to say, this was just lovely. Thank you. But I was particularly struck at the very beginning when you said, when you were sitting with a person who's going to die, you said, what I am being allowed to do. I just thought that was so, I don't know, just beautiful.
Well, there's this incredible paradox. People tell me what an amazing thing it is that I sit with the dying. And I have to say back, now what an incredible honor it is to be able to sit with the dying.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing that hasn't come back to me tenfold by that. You know, I sit, I mean, listen to how I'm talking. This is not a lawyer, you know? I mean, it's like what incredible richness has come into my life because I've been honored to sit with people who, if I saw them on the street historically, I might have crossed to the other side not to be bothered. I mean, what happened to me happens to so many of us about compartmentalizing and containing and protecting ourselves. And when you look at that harder, what are we protecting ourselves? Well, we're protecting ourselves from control issues and change issues. And, you know, I now, when I walk around town in San Francisco, and there are a lot of street people here, I generally have a roll of $1 bills. And I have a roll of $1 bills because most street people, I'll stop to give them a dollar, and it's not the dollar that counts. I will look them in the eyes and ask them how they're doing. And
okay.
The dollar becomes the vehicle for me to have them look at me and me look at them and basically say, I see you.
Mm.
Because that's really what we want out of life. We want to be seen. We don't want to be seen as rich or famous. We just want people to acknowledge that we're here, that we're somehow connected. That's what I've learned out of this experience. And that's, you know, I'm writing the second book now, which since I kind of figured it was outrageous to do Death Tweet, I'm doing Death Tweet 2. So it's kind of like a series of movies. But Death Tweet 2 is 140 perspectives on being a supportive witness at the end of life. That is, now you're going to sit with someone who's dying. How can you do that without fleeing? How can you do that and remain calm enough and aware enough that you can actually help that person in that final transformation? And I will tell you the responsibility that I feel in my choice of words and the messages I'm giving out is 10 times this first book. I mean, because I don't want I want people to recognize what an incredibly I was raised Catholic. I'm not in the church at this point, but this is a holy experience. This is one of the greatest things you could ever do is to be there for someone in that transition. I watched all my children be born, and I've watched I don't know how many people die, and they're the same kind of process. Beginnings and endings are just incredibly powerful, and they are completely connected. There's no way to not be fully engaged to the point where when I sit with people dying, I disappear. That is, I have no awareness of myself whatsoever. I am so available to the dying person that I don't exist. I am them.
My question, Tim, this is your sister-in-law, Susan.
Hey, Susan.
How you doing?
Good.
I have to say I'm tremendously impressed with everything that you've said tonight, and I need to know how you got there, because I remember when you and Nancy got married, and you were a highfalutin California lawyer, and you have become a 180-year, I don't even know, maybe 360-degree changed person. And I can't even tell you the incredible, I don't even know how to say it, you know, how I have seen you change and become a person that is so aware of others and so much involved with others. And I know that the cancer had something to do with that, but I feel like there's more.
Well, there's a part of me that says maybe this is my purpose. I mean, maybe everything I went through and all the raging hormones and the self-importance I experienced was in order to get me to the point of being slapped across the forehead with a 2x4 and come to a realization that that's not a real way to live.
So do you have to go through that to get
no,
this
I don't
far?
Think, no, I think part of what I'm trying to do here is I did it the hard way. Is there an easier way? I think it's got to do with slowing down. Now, part of what my difficulty, I think, was that I'm very ADD. I'm very cranked up.
And you were working 18 hours a day.
Yeah, so it was very hard for me to drop back enough. So cancer was kind of like wake up stupid. Do I think a lot of people need a real difficult time to come awake? Yeah, I think a lot of people do. But then there's all these other folks who... I mean, if I could turn this into a pill and give it away, I'd be just doing it day in and day out, because there's no reason to be miserable. I mean, I feel like my kids didn't have a dad for a number of years while I was figuring this stuff out. Now I think they've got a dad that writes stories about the dying and talks like I talk, and I'm hoping that in some small way they won't ever forget that I had to make this change, and that I made this change in part out of the necessity to model for them a different way of being. And I do the same for Nancy. I mean, I want to feel like all of this. It's like, see me, mommy. This is all worth it. This is all worth it. And then, you know, the funny part about it is there's no end game. This doesn't kind of, like, you don't get somewhere and say, oh, I'm here. You know, it's kind of this amazing thing. Like that email I read to you guys, I mean, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
And so I emailed him back, and I said, please call me. Here's my number. And so out of that, I'm probably going to know a guy in Virginia who's in level 4 brain tumor and with a level 4 brain cancer, and he will die, because that's what level 4 generally means.
But you're going to be there for him.
Well, I'm going to know him, and he's going to know I'm here, and it's going to be maybe a phone call or two.
Yeah.
And then it's that connection's made. The funny part is that we can have hundreds, if not thousands, of these connections, because they all don't require huge amounts of time or energy. They require the ability to connect. And and it's really just that connection that I'm thinking is much simpler and we've overlooked for so long. And, you know, I call it secular spiritualism because I'm not, you know, I'm trying to avoid any line of demarcation that says you have to be Jewish or Catholic or Christian or Buddhist or Hindu to get this. This is completely, totally available to atheists.
Yeah.
It's just that the regard you have to have is the regard for others. That's, you know, and if you get to the regard for others, I think this stuff starts to really work.
Hey, Tim, I hope that not only the people who are listening now, but also those that will listen to the recorded session we have, really spend the time to walk through this with you, because every time I talk to you, I learn something new, and this was no exception. I
have to agree.
Yeah, I take away three words that I want to figure out how to live my life by, and those words are, I see you.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me. I'm going back and forth on the title for your second book instead of being Death Tweet 2. Maybe it's I See You Tweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe
I like that better.
Title.
I agree.
I like the Death Tweet theme, and that's good too. But I one of the things you might be able to do, Tim, and certainly anyone who's listening today, send an email to info@happyabout.info, and how do you see somebody? I mean, what is it that you're going to do? I mean, Tim, I do that too. I've got the bill of, you know, I've got a roll of dollars and I hand them to people. But, you know, I really hadn't thought about stopping, looking in their eyes. I mean, occasionally I'll say hello, right? Or, I mean, I'm not rude, but I hadn't thought about looking at them in their eyes and saying, how are you? Or just something that helps them recognize that I see them. And I think that's really powerful, really amazing.
I really like the title, I See You. I think that's an amazing perception of where Tim's going with all of this.
See, I married into the coolest family, I must admit. You know, I told Nancy that if I hadn't found her and I'd found her family, I would have married into them one way or another.
How kind of you, Tim.
So let me read the last tweet of this book, which really, to some extent, summarizes everything you're talking about. And then Tim, give us a closing comment after that. But tweet 140 is, as you live in awareness, pursue curiosity and embrace generosity as you see life's meaning arising from your relation to others. And I think that's beautiful and really tells the story of the message you want to communicate. Why don't you add a couple minutes to that, and then we'll call it a session.
Well, you know, I see coming out of this, for me, a new community of people to communicate with. It's amazing. I've gotten calls from psychologists and psychiatrists and clergy and business types. And it's really the thing that I love most about what I see happening out of just putting these ideas out is that people from such disparate parts of the world have said, thank God you've said these things, which makes me believe that the community that is available to talk about this, that's available to think about this, really doesn't fall neatly into categories. And there's something really big here. And, you know, I'm not finding movements and I'm not trying to start anything, but I think that the message here is so simple that if you can own it yourself, you can offer it to another. And that's really what the whole effort's about. If you can quiet down and become very real and make that available to someone else, they can do the same thing, and it starts to change the world. That's, you know, that's a different aspiration than I had when I was 28.
Wow. Tim, thank you so much. We've been with Tim Tosser, author of Death Tweet, available at Amazon.com, HappyAbout.com, ThinkAha.com. You can pick up your book at the ThinkAha iPhone app, which currently is free, as well as various ebook and other physical booksellers across the world. This has been Tim Topter. I am Mitchell Levy, and I thank you very much for joining us today. Have yourself a wonderful day, and I see you.
Thank you, Mitchell.
Thank you.
Tim.